Good evening, James McKinney here with my Science Hour for December 13th, 2018. A few topics to cover tonight, and one I'll be talking about in the scientific sense is Voyager 2 has just crossed what is known as the heliopause. That's the region where our sun's influence ends and the intergalactic medium begins. In other words, our sun's effect has ceased, where Voyager 2 has just crossed through that region. And one might ask, well, what's it like there? What did it detect? And it's simply a difference in direction from the wind that's coming by, the protons and the et cetera. It's no longer coming from our sun. But first of all, a couple announcements. I got an email. It was a broadcast email from a man named Roger Stone. Roger Stone was instrumental in a lot of information during the Trump campaign, etc., and he's being clearly targeted as a political target by the Mueller witch hunt investigation thing. And the Democrat Congress is going after him, making all kinds of claims. But the problem is, when they do this, they're doing it for a reason, and that is because you need legal defense. You need professional legal defense to deal with the allegations and things like that. Otherwise, a person is just setting themselves up for legal disaster. So as his bills run into the millions, of course, the whole purpose of this, as they try to do with Jerome Corsi, with Michael Lynch, and anybody else associated with Trump, they try and destroy them financially, their family, make them sell their house, just make life uncomfortable, so that trying to send a message that if you help a political candidate that is on the opposite side as the New World Order, you're going to get the business. And so anyway, that is what's going on. And so I would encourage you to take a look at Roger Stone's webpage, and he's asking people to donate money. And so I wouldn't ask you to donate money to him if I didn't think it was necessary and a good cause. Because this kind of political targeting of people is this is Orwellian. This is the kind of thing you would see in Lenin's Russia, or whatever, and the targeting of political enemies. And of course, that happened all throughout the Obama years, where they used the IRS to target political enemies and other vindictive methods using government agencies, not the least of which was spying on individuals. So once again, the visit that webpage, Roger Stone, and see what this is all about, and then consider donating something to help the legal fund there. It's a very strange world, and lately, let me just give another example here of corruption within government. The Southern District of New York is opening up a grand jury, at least the word is that's going to happen, to study the case of 9/11, the Twin Towers that came down in New York City. The only problem is they have a couple, basically what I've always considered disinformation plants, controlled or planted opposition, Judy Wood being one, who claims that the towers came down because of a secret government ray machine, energy beam machine, which is totally ludicrous. And then another guy called Cage that talks about thermite being a possible source for bringing down the Twin Towers. But be that as it may, the whole issue is not necessarily the exact cause, because there's no evidence anymore to follow up and determine what actually made those towers fall down. But the real issue is, who did it? And why? And where was the, you want to talk conspiracy theories? There's one there that you can wrap your teeth around, because it was clearly an inside job with the U.S. government fully involved, fully engaged, along with no doubt Israel and Saudi Arabia, who are, you know, supposedly mortal enemies, but really not mortal enemies. But the point is that this alleged investigation is a ruse. It's not going to solve, it's going to waste a lot of time and energy jumping down the wrong rabbit holes. And of course, that's what it's designed to do. This is once again planted opposition disinformation, using and misusing the court system to jump down the wrong rabbit holes. A quick announcement. Last week, I announced that we were out of the MR500. These are the whole house water filters. And we're waiting for a new stainless steel container to come in so that then we'll be reselling them with the, or selling them with the stainless steel container. But that was supposed to happen. And as with pretty much anything with development, at the stainless steel containers are going to be delayed maybe as much as another month. So in the meantime, I just made a sale concept, and this was actually due to a customer ordering one. And I said, well, how about this? We're out of the MR5s. We just ran out. I'll offer you buy the MR5 with an extra maintenance kit, which includes a complete pack of the filter elements, and then plus an extra UV light and some other hardware that go in this whole house filter. And we'll add $600, so I'll send you a $600 invoice, and we'll send you the same filter, but an MR9, which is double the filter, basically, a much better filter in terms of capacity, etc. It's basically the same filtration system, just twice as big. And the housing is really not that much bigger. It's only 4 inches in diameter bigger and 2 inches taller, the main housing. And so anyway, that was successful. And then some other people jumped on the bandwagon. And we've got about five right now on the shelf, another five of the MR9s sitting there waiting to be shipped. And so the first five people to jump on this deal will get a really, really good deal, because typically, that difference in price would be about $2,000. Even with the sale prices that are on the webpage, it would be around over $1,500, and I'm giving it to you for an additional $600. So a really, really good deal. So once again, just go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Click on the link at the top to the Secure Web Ordering page, and then scroll down on the Secure Web Ordering page to the whole house filters, and it explains everything there. So you basically order an MR500 with the extra filter set. I think it's $2,750 is the price. And then we will send you the $600 invoice. You pay that, and then we send you the MR9 with the extra filter pack and replacement kit, it's called. But a super deal. You will never, ever see this again in history. So anyway, just wanted to let you know that. Also want people to know that the paid casts are posted on my webpage, and these are very, very important 1 hour sessions every week, and gives you an extra deep dive into scientific topics. So, and also, if you do not have my books yet, it's a good way to get my ebook set at half price. So that all that information also at the top of my webpage. And if you have not been to the webpage recently, I have a picture of the wing generator at the test site where the testing occurred for the XPRIZE, of which I won the annual XPRIZE Technology Innovation Achievement Award. So that was a big accomplishment. And the setup that was used is there with the wing generator, the tower, the two water machines, my own product line of water machines, and then two of the catchment tanks. They're called totes, 1,000 liters sitting in the foreground. But that setup sitting on a trailer bed And then all of the electronics are in the container, the shipping container that's on a trailer bed. And of course, the whole idea here is that you can take a shipping container, take it out into the middle of nowhere, and that location had no power, no water, and in the middle of nowhere, you can set up and using the wind, have energy, abundant energy, and abundant water. So that picture at the top of my homepage, jmccsci.com. So make sure you check that out. It's really worth seeing. And as far as the wing generator is concerned, that is moving forward. And so more details on that upcoming in the future. All right. Tonight I'm going to talk primarily about Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Now, it's been 40 years since they arrived at Jupiter and Saturn. Now, there was a previous set of spacecraft called Pioneers, and they went out to visit Jupiter, and I think they also got to Saturn. And but the Voyager 1 and 2 were very sophisticated, intelligent machines that took a tremendous amount of data and proved that Jupiter has a proton wind. They could see the protons coming up off of Jupiter. And that's when it confirmed my suspicion that Jupiter was a small star. And, of course, you could take a picture of Jupiter prior to that in the infrared and see all of the heat signatures, which do not correspond at all with solar radiation. These are signatures of Jupiter being a small unlit star. So it turns out that Jupiter is the companion star to our own star, the Sun. And so that I realized, then that led me to understand the process for fusion in the atmosphere of stars, which is not down in the core, but up in the atmosphere. And the fusion fire, basically a nuclear fire, is kicked off by electrical currents, very powerful electrical currents and their associated magnetic fields. And it allowed me to predict that when the spacecraft got to Saturn, that Saturn would be more energetic in terms of fusion, and the wind, the proton wind coming off Saturn, would, was about three times as powerful as that going on in Jupiter. In other words, Jupiter was an older star and had cooled down considerably, had burnt up a good deal of its hydrogen in its atmosphere, reforming into helium, deuterium, and moving on up the chemical chain. But the significance of Voyager 2, this was in the news this week, the Voyager 2 crossing the heliopause. Now, this is the region after which the Sun's influence ends. So it passes, and so what does it look like? Well, looking back on the solar system at that point, the Sun would be just another star, maybe a little bit bigger than an average star, but not much. The conditions there are simply that the magnetic field is no longer that of our Sun. The magnetic field and the direction of flow of charged particles, protons, electrons, etc., would be coming out from our galactic nucleus. And so the fact that we have this, what is known as a bow shock, in other words, the Sun's magnetic field ends and blocks radiation from coming in from the galactic environment. And when I say radiation, what I'm talking about is the proton-supported wind of the galactic environment, which, by the way, we are out in the boondocks. In our galaxy, we are in the far, far distant country. And it's very interesting, just a kind of a fun fact, fun thought here, is that if we were much farther in towards the center of the galaxy with a high abundance of stars close by in a, say, a star cluster, we probably would not be aware of others, like even the galaxy. We would only be aware of our local star systems because the light would be so great, the amount of light filtering into our atmosphere would be so great, it would be like constant daytime almost. So a civilization living in those inner city quarters of the galaxy would be like city dwellers. Isn't it interesting that people will come from a city, say they grew up in a city, never been out in the country, and they come to some place to visit, and they're out in the country, and they look up and they go, what are all those dots all over up in the sky? Not knowing that they're stars, never seen the stars or possibly even the moon, which is bright. So just an interesting thought that the civilizations that would live in towards the center of the galaxy may not be as space aware as we are living out in the boondocks. Okay, anyway, the real heralding of Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are the engineers who built these amazing spacecraft. Now, the people we visibly see would be, say, NASA scientists interpreting the data, getting publications in Science or Nature magazine or other publications, and years afterwards analyzing data. And one might think that they would be able to interpret the data and give you a correct analysis based on the exactness and the very fine engineering of these spacecraft. But that's not the case. What I found when I was at Cornell, that was, you know, these two spacecraft, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, were the preeminent spacecraft. And if you look throughout history, I mean, we have the New Horizons spacecraft, which gave us information about Pluto. We have other spacecraft that concentrated, like the Galileo mission to Jupiter, or the Cassini mission to Saturn, which produced tremendous amounts of data because they went in orbit around those planets and stayed there and studied and orbited and were able to take photographs of incidents as they happened in the region of those planets. But it was the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 that really opened the door up to space investigation. And what did NASA do instead of going in with an open mind and saying, okay, we're just going to take a very open approach to this? No, they came in and they said, we're going to confirm all of our pet theories no matter what the data says. They erased data, they destroyed data, they corrupted data, they changed data, they did everything possible to hide electromagnetic effects because they weren't supposed to be there, and on and on and on. And that continues up until today. The Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft accomplished all types of scientific goals outside of the scope of NASA's interests. And when I was on the Power Hour Tuesday, a couple days ago, with Daniel Brigman, with the host, I was explaining that there, you might think, are these just stupid scientists? But there's an agenda to keep the public dumbed down about the electrical nature of the universe. And so my work, it was instrumental in opening up the gates towards the thinking about this. My theoretical work explained how these phenomenon work, yet people are still talking about dirty snowballs and gravity-only effects in a universe that's filled with electrical phenomenon. But the other thing that the Voyagers did was to take pictures, close-up pictures, just nose-to-nose with Jupiter, with Saturn, and to give us real insight in different wavelengths what these planets were like. For the first time, we saw the tumultuous atmosphere of Jupiter with the bands, 11 bands going around the planet Jupiter in counter-rotating directions. So each band would rotate in the opposite direction of the next band, and so they were symmetrical around the north and the south pole of Jupiter. Very interesting. But these were electrical currents, once again, with protons and positively charged ions in one direction and primarily electrons in the other direction. With the storm systems rotating around the planet like the Great Red Spot. And when NASA, I remember when they were first, before the Voyager spacecraft got to Jupiter, they thought maybe the Great Red Spot was just literally like a spot on the surface of the planet, even though they knew that the atmosphere of Jupiter had to be gaseous. There was some kind of just fixed structure. And then, of course, when you get there, it's a giant hurricane. Well, how do hurricanes work on Jupiter? That was a total mystery. Well, there again, my work showed that it's the electrical connection to outside of the planet that is part of the overall electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. And that is what's driving the Great Red Spot storm. The Great Red Spot eats other storm systems and combines with them. So there's literally hundreds of cyclonic storm systems in the atmosphere of Jupiter, just as with Saturn. But the one that's most visible from Earth, of course, was originally seen by Galileo with his little handmade telescope. But was the first one to see that Great Red Spot. And then, of course, the four moons of Jupiter are called the Galilean moons, after Galileo, who discovered them. So, but the Voyagers were just amazing machines. They had to be timed because there was not enough time to send a signal from Earth to the spacecraft for it to react because it was moving. So all of this had to be pre-programmed, and all of the camera, the photos had to be pointed at exactly the right direction. Can you imagine, say, having an assignment to take photographs of some event, like a gathering in a gymnasium or something, but you were not able to see your camera. You were not where your camera was. And besides that, the amount of time it took to communicate with your camera was on the order of minutes and longer. And so if something was going on, you couldn't just send a signal to change the camera. All this had to be pre-programmed. And once again, credit due to the great engineering staffs at the engineering firms that built the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft. And the other thing that's amazing is that they are still communicating. And so I'll just discuss that a little bit, because here's the point where most people are not real familiar. I mean, people are familiar with cameras and photographs, digital photography, sending digital photography in digital format. But the telecommunications, how did that work? How did we get signals from Jupiter to Earth, and how did we get signals from Earth to Jupiter to send commands or change programs, etc.? And it turns out that they're in the essential part of the Voyager spacecraft communications function was called, it's called a Marconi oscillator. Now, Marconi oscillator is simply a type of oscillator electronic circuit that creates an oscillating time-varying signal. And so it's basically a carrier wave or a carrier signal. And then you have one of those in the spacecraft, you have one of them at Earth, and they're tuned and locked together. I did an experiment when I was in college. My senior thesis used a similar set of techniques to take a signal, a noisy signal out of a signal, a transmission signal out of a noisy electrical environment. And what I was using was a multi-channel oscillator, but something similar to the Marconi oscillator on the Voyager spacecraft. So what you had then was a sending and receiving carrier signal that had a very set frequency. And not only a set frequency, but a set phase. And so the sending and receiving stations were locked together in phase and in frequency. Now, this caused some very interesting effects, which I'll talk about in a couple minutes, that proved that Jupiter had electrical an electrical environment. But anyway, if you have a noisy environment like outer space where there's a lot of electrical noise and you have a little faint signal in there, how do you capture that signal? How do you lift it out from all of this noise in the background? Well, it turns out that the vast majority of the noise in outer space is not at your set frequency. Your set frequency of the Marconi oscillator is just one frequency. So all of this noise, you filter out with what's called a narrow band filter. So it's a filter that only lets a very specific wavelength of electromagnetic radiation of radio signal through. And then you connect it into your Marconi oscillator in the same way as you send. You're sending on that very limited frequency, and it's in phase with the oscillator that's on the spacecraft. Okay, so now you can, with that technique, you can basically lift a signal, a very faint signal, out of a very noisy electrical environment and transmit data, the zeros and ones, which are basically the binary or digital number system. And so it takes a bit of time to transmit the data, but given the spacecraft is traveling and it's going to be months until it arrives at the next destination, or actually years, you have plenty of time to move data. And so, but the interesting thing, what I was going to mention, is that when the Marconi oscillators on the Voyager spacecraft got to Jupiter, they redshifted. In other words, the frequency changed. And, of course, NASA scientists were unable to explain why this might be. And then as it passed by Jupiter, the Voyager spacecraft, the Marconi oscillator went back to normal. Well, was it the oscillator that was changing frequency? Well, no. The frequency of the oscillator itself was not changing. What was changing was the frequency that was reaching Earth. And so there was some condition there that was altering the frequency, and it went to the red side, in other words, the lower energy side of the electromagnetic spectrum. And so I knew exactly what that meant. I was in the meetings when this data was coming in, and everybody else was like, well, what does this mean? They couldn't figure it out. And I knew that that meant that Jupiter had a proton wind, and that, in fact, came out in the data, too. It was Jupiter supported a proton wind, just like the Sun. So that meant that Jupiter had ongoing fusion in its atmosphere, and that also was conclusive proof that the core fusion model of the Sun had to be incorrect. And those were all things that I had predicted, and not only predicted, but explained with theories, theoretical work, that showed that the fusion could not possibly be in the core of the Sun, and the Jupiter situation confirmed that, because Jupiter, by the core fusion model, does not have enough mass to ignite the fusion process. So it would be impossible for Jupiter to have fusion and a solar wind by the core fusion model. And so really one of the tremendous discoveries of Voyager, which was completely ignored, as far as NASA is concerned, they didn't even know about it. And of course, they would not allow anybody else's papers to be published. So this has gone basically by the wayside ever since. And clearly, let me just make a caveat here. When the Galileo mission was orbiting Jupiter for years, it would have constantly been involved in Marconi oscillator frequency change, as seen from planet Earth. But NASA, once again, would ignore this and just sweep the data under the rug. the one of the most important discoveries that Cassini, or not Cassini, but Galileo could have made around Jupiter would be exactly that. And, I mean, just look at the number of theories that go by the wayside. The core fusion model of the sun is incorrect. The redshift concept of the Big Bang would be incorrect. I mean, these are major cornerstones of astronomical theory, and they would simply go by the wayside. So, notwithstanding new information, new discoveries, NASA would not allow those kind of changes and just basically ignored the data, swept the data under the rug. So, another great discovery of the Voyagers was the confirmation, something I predicted also, in actually a peer-reviewed published paper, that Saturn would have moonlets in the ring gaps. And that would be what was causing the gaps in the rings. And it was very understandable using the plasma discharge comet model and the fact that Saturn was a small star with ongoing fusion, which supported its own capacitor, that the moons were acting like comets in the ring system and causing the rings to fade in the way that we see them. And sure enough, when the Voyager spacecraft got to Saturn, those moonlets were discovered. So once again, proving conclusively my predictions, but once again, being totally ignored, not only ignored, but buried by NASA. The whole issue with the Voyager 1 and 2 is that they were tremendous spacecraft, made tremendous discoveries, which were obfuscated and basically destroyed by NASA to maintain its ludicrous pet theories. So the other thing we learned, say, from Saturn is that there were 27, no less than 27 moons of Saturn that had to have been captured. In other words, they were not part of the original Saturn moon system. And the way you realize this is because of their orbits. Their orbits are skewed. They're not commensurate with something that formed originally with the planet Saturn. So 27 of Saturn's many, many moons had to have been captured, and that was one of my primary objectives also in my theoretical work, was to show that the planets and moons were captured. And that a very small percentage of them nestle into nice, clean orbits. For example, we have Earth and Venus and Mars and Jupiter, all in nice, neat orbits, but Mercury is not. Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, is not in a nice, clean, circular orbit. It's elliptical. It has other issues. As far as being a normal, what you'd call a normal circular orbit, it's not in the plane of the planets. From all aspects, it looks like a brand new contribution to the solar system. It does not look like it's been there very long, other than its surface, which looks like it's very old. The other option there is that Mercury was affected by some large passing celestial object, which changed its orbit, and also recently. But getting back to Voyager 1 and 2. The other thing we discovered from Voyager 1 and 2 is the differentiation of base materials in the solar system. We know that around Earth we have a lot of water, hydrogen and oxygen. Around Jupiter, it's sulfur and oxygen in the form of sulfur dioxide. And so, for example, in 1997, when the comet Schumacher-Levy 9, with 21 pieces, it broke up, and there were 21 pieces that came into the region around Jupiter. Originally, when they were out in free outer space away from Jupiter, they were water comets. And one by one, as they came into the realm of Jupiter, they became sulfur dioxide comets. And that, of course, is due to the fact that the comet tail material is coming into the comet nucleus, and it is based on the local environmental chemical species. In this case, in the region around Jupiter, sulfur dioxide. But that was seen from Earth-based telescopes, basically the Hubble Space Telescope. But just another little discovery regarding Jupiter. But all of the phenomena you see around Jupiter are readily explained, the ring systems, etc., the cyclonic storms in the atmosphere, the counter-rotating rings. All of this is electrical, and it has nothing to do with solar. Well, not it's, I shouldn't say nothing, but extremely little to do with the light that comes away from the sun. So to put Band-Aids on the failing theories, NASA made up theories like, the gravitational collapse of atmosphere is what causes the excess energy in Jupiter and in Saturn, which is absurd because they're not changing shape, they're not collapsing, they're not changing size, etc. The point I want to make here is that as early as 1979 from the Pioneer and the two Voyager spacecraft, the Voyager 1 and 2, as they passed Jupiter, it was very clear that Jupiter was not a planet, that the core fusion model of the sun could not possibly be correct, that Jupiter had its own solar wind, and that the fusion was up in the atmosphere, and therefore it had to be the same for the sun. It would be the same physical process. And you could see the same physical processes happening in the sun and at Jupiter. The list goes on and on. When the I was talking earlier about the Marconi oscillators and the fact that when the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft came to Jupiter, the Marconi oscillator, which is very stable, redshifted. The frequency changed, but the frequency did not change in the oscillator itself. It was what came to Earth because the electric field of Jupiter, the non-uniform electric field around Jupiter, caused the redshifting of the frequency of the Marconi oscillator. Of the Marconi oscillator signal, not of the Marconi oscillator itself. But at that point, I made a prediction that when the Voyager spacecraft got to Saturn, because I knew Saturn was more active, that the redshifting would be greater than that of Jupiter. And originally, the NASA scientists came out and they tried to say, well, there's a redshift because of general relativity, the mass of Jupiter is redshifting this signal. But the equations for redshifting a signal due to mass are very well known, and Jupiter has nowhere near the mass to redshift a signal to the point where you could measure it. But then the contradiction came along that when the Marconi oscillators on the Voyager craft got to Saturn, they redshifted more than at Jupiter, and Saturn is smaller, less massive. So once again, the idea that the redshifting of the frequency, the carrier signal for the communications, was redshifted due to general relativity could not possibly be true. But at that point, everybody dropped it. They stopped talking about it. Likewise, when the Cassini mission was at Saturn orbiting and orbiting repeatedly, it would have been very clear to those receiving the signal that the frequency of the Marconi oscillator would be changing. It would be reduced, and therefore something was going on, something certainly unknown. And, of course, once again, NASA simply for the decades, which the Galileo mission, the Cassini mission, and the Voyager missions, it had to be very clear to the people receiving those signals that they were redshifted, and that there was no physical reason for that to occur, and it just sat there without explanation. And those are the kind of basic fundamental physics issues that you don't just overlook. And, of course, I did not overlook it, but At that point, NASA had made a decision, and probably had been made for them, that they couldn't go there. They couldn't discuss those issues, etc. Okay, so then Voyager 1 and 2 continue out and research the other outer planets, Uranus and Neptune. And at that point, we find out that that region of the solar system is dominated by nitrogen compounds. So in around Earth and Mars in that region, the chemical species are hydrogen and oxygen. Around Jupiter, sulfur and oxygen. Around Uranus, nitrogen and oxygen and hydrogen. And then around Neptune, nitrogen compounds. And then, by the way, when we finally get out to Pluto, the planet Pluto, with the New Horizons spacecraft, the, once again, nitrogen compounds. So those nitrogen compounds are very dominant out in that region, the very far region of the solar system. And I've talked about this before recently on my paid cast. I've been talking about the planets, but Pluto, when they first approached it, acted as a comet. You could see the comet tails visibly around Pluto and its moon Charon. You could see the tails moving in the video footage, actually sequential photos that were put together in the form of a video, but you could see the tail around Pluto moving around and clearly reacting to the electrical discharges that are going on. And the material, when there were close-up photos of Pluto and the Pluto atmosphere, it was snowing. It was just snowing down to the surface of Pluto, but there were no clouds. This material was just falling in from outer space on a continual basis. And you could see also the upwelling coming from the internal part of Pluto, making basically a broth. And I've posted on my Pictures of the Day webpage, you can see this. There's a picture of Pluto surface, and then there's a picture of a concoction that I made and boiled it on a stove. I call it the milk boil, but it looks exactly like the surface of Pluto. Now, the surface of Pluto is primarily very cold nitrogen compounds, but the end effect is the same. So the internals of Pluto, that means that the inside of Pluto has a heat source, which if it were 4.5 billion years old, it would not have. Once again, negating any idea that the planets all formed at one time. In fact, it's very clear that Pluto is forming right now. And I've talked before about Earth and Jupiter, Saturn, all the planets bringing in material on an ongoing basis. In fact, I've talked about the Sun bringing in hydrogen. And so that's another interesting aspect about Voyager 2 crossing the heliopause of the Sun, is that the Sun is acting as a giant comet with its interaction with the galactic wind, and it has an extensive tail system, which is, it's a comet. The Sun is acting as a comet, and the influx of material, the hydrogen coming in to our Sun, is what fuels the hydrogen fire, the fusion fire, in the upper atmosphere of our Sun, and on an ongoing basis. So these are, turns out that our Sun is dependent on influx of material from the galactic environment. So it's like a feeding process where Jupiter is feeding within the Sun's capacitor. The Sun is feeding within the capacitor of the galactic proton wind and the electric field, even though we're way out here. I suspect that the bow shock of the galaxy is probably far beyond where we are, even though our Sun and our entire solar system is in the very far reaches of the Milky Way galaxy. So Voyager 1 and 2 have really provided a lot of information, a lot of very valuable information. And they're just, once again, engineering marvels to imagine that these are still communicating with Earth with that little signal. And I forget how weak it is, but it's about, they say, the remember those little transistor radios you could put in your pocket, and they were powered by a little pen, like 1.5-volt battery, that's about how much power is being used to transmit signals to Earth. Yeah, just an incredibly small amount of power, but because of the engineering of the telecommunications aspect of the Voyager spacecraft, they can still transmit and receive signals from Earth. Absolutely incredible. So certainly engineering marvels. But then in one of the articles I saw on the Voyager 2 crossing over into the out of the heliosphere, the sun-controlled region, that they talked about its distance to the Oort cloud. Now, they said in another 300 years it might reach what is termed incorrectly, of course, but the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is named after a Norwegian, I believe, scientist who speculated in the 1800s, as I recall. Not that I was there at the time, but he speculated that comets originated in a region way out away from the sun called the Oort cloud. And of course, speculating based on the concept that these objects were ice balls. Well, they're not ice balls, and they really, the reason for that determination was because the majority of comets had long-term orbits. In other words, they would come into the solar system, whip around, and go back out. And as best as they could tell, the majority of comets had a hypothetical orbital distance at this from the sun, very far out. And what I've discovered, however, is that since comets, which would come in from intergalactic space, since they have tail drag, the drag that the tail exerts on the comets, it gives the orbits the appearance of having the outer axis of their orbit at that particular distance from the sun. So it's really a misnomer. It's really a lack of understanding by Oort and his colleagues and literally everybody that's come afterwards, that the distance to the Oort cloud is commensurate with objects coming in, and they didn't understand about drag or the orbital change of comets, of long period comets. And the real reason is because of tail drag, something that you wouldn't start or you wouldn't understand unless you understood the plasma discharge comet model. And of course, there's nobody in the standard scientific community that even studies in that direction or will cross the borderline in that direction, because they wouldn't be employed very long if they were to raise serious objections against standard theory. So anyway, let me review a number of the theoretical propositions that I had back in the old days and how many were verified. For example, capture as a method of developing solar systems. I mentioned that Saturn had 27 moons that had to have been captured, and probably most of the other ones had been captured also, did not come in as original members of the Saturnia or of Saturn's original planetary system. But the whole idea of capture as the formation, capture as a process that is fundamental to solar system formation, was essential to my work, that comets and comet nuclei would become captured into the solar system and then develop as planets, the big comets, not the little ones, but all of them. And that somewhat raises the question of what is a planet. If Venus, for example, is a brand new planet, it's still acting as a comet. When did it stop being a comet? And when did it start becoming or start its life as a planet? So that's an interesting question, because we know, for example, Venus is still affecting Earth. This is actually in the medical journals, that during the inferior conjunction of Venus, there is a tremendous rise in influenza. And this goes all the way back to the Chinese in the 1200s, who first discovered this association. And they called it swine flu or bird flu. And the typical viruses that are built in the tail of a comet, built up from the nucleotides. We know there are nucleotides in the tail of a comet because one of the comet probes at Comet Vild, the Stardust comet probe, picked up material from the tail of a comet, brought it back, and they found nucleotides, so highly developed organic molecules that are the building blocks of DNA and RNA. Found these in the tail of a comet. So the idea that viruses, very rudimentary organic large molecules, basically is what they are, that then are foreign to the human body and can wreak havoc with the human body in the form of what we call flu. And what is flu is simply your body's immune system reacting to a foreign substance, one that it does not recognize in its vast intellectual array of patterns and what to do with it. So basically, influenza is your body responding to a foreign substance, a virus, in your system. And it takes a while for your antibody system to kick up and start removing it. And in the meantime, you have all of these symptoms that we call flu or influenza. But anyway, the point is that every time we go through the tail of Venus, we pick up a new strain or new strains of influenza. And it takes a while for the human to, and this idea of a flu shot is absolutely bizarre and absurd, because what they do in a flu shot is they give you last year or 2 years ago flu virus in supposedly a dead form. And a lot of people who really did not get sick before from the natural flu virus get it when they get the shot, because they had not built up an immune system. And so as many people get sick with the flu from the shots, as and possibly more than the people who don't take the shots. So another marvel of modern medicine explained. But the fact that Venus's tail is active and we pass through it and we have physical measurable processes going on also when that electrical alignment of Earth and Venus occurs during the inferior conjunction of Venus, when Venus is between Earth and the Sun. The Sun has excessive sunspots. And so that's another explanation that is covered with the plasma discharge comet model, understanding that Earth and Venus are acting as comets. So are they comets? Are they planets? Are they both? Is a comet and a planet the same thing? Is a small comet with a small nucleus like Halley's really a potential comet in development or planet in development? Well, if it stays around long enough, it might be. The idea that these things melt away and go away, the reality is that nobody has ever seen a nucleus of a comet melt away, because the main reason, they're not made of snow and ice, but they do have erosion, and the erosion comes literally from the electron beam coming from the sun, carving on the nucleus of small comets. It's actually like an electron beam or like a plasma cutter. In the welding world, they cut steel even with electric plasma arcs. So comets have the same phenomenon. And so the electron beam is what carves into the rocky surface of the comet nucleus, or if nothing else, bakes on the hydrocarbons onto the surface. But there's nothing melting off the surface of a comet. That's absurd. And of all the comets we've visited, including landing on a comet, there's no snow, ice, or water, and there's nothing boiling or sublimating off the nucleus. It's never been observed. You know, so that's a bit of absurdity also. So anyway, I wanted to give you a little bit of background on Voyager 1 and 2 and their passage from the solar system out into the galactic medium. I just want to remind you the sale that I have on, the MR-900s, and the you get the MR-900 with a maintenance kit in place of the MR-500. So go to my webpage, the sales page, for all the details. And so basically the total cost to you, and this is actually a pretty remarkable price, is the $2,750 and then plus $600. So that's $3,350 for an MR9 filter, which typically is $5,000, plus the maintenance kit. We're talking a hefty price here for only $3,300. And I'll just throw in a little beating my drum here that when you compare to other whole house filters that are on the market, I'm not going to name brand names, but all they are is a charcoal filter. It's really pathetic. And the filters for my whole house filters have all the same filtration properties as the countertop gravity feed or the inline filters that I sell on my webpage, and includes a final UV ultraviolet filter. It's called a filter, but it's really a light that kills any viruses or bacteria. And this is for the whole house. So you get rid of the chlorines and the fluorides and the glyphosates and the lead and the other heavy metals, all of this being removed from the water for the laundry, for showers. And just a comment, you do want to get these chemicals out of the water. The worst place of what I believe a lot of people get cancer is from showering in hot water that is basically a chemical bath. And then you're breathing that in. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible what they put into city water in many places in the country. And this whole house filter takes it out, gets the chlorine out when you wash your clothes, all of the lint and damage to your clothes being done by the chlorines in the water. Oh, my goodness. And if you're in agricultural areas, the glyphosate, you got to get that cancer-causing glyphosate out of your water. And then also remember the paid cast, $3.95 a month for an extra deep dive into scientific topics, all on my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.